Legend of Yue Fei, Chapter 78.
Let's start with the enemy, Pu Feng.
Okay, Pu Feng. He's a monk, holds the title National Master for the enemy side. He's actually returning after being defeated once before.
But he doesn't seem humbled by that defeat at all.
Not one bit. The arrogance is just dripping off him. When he meets his allies, he talks about the Song soldiers, thousands of trained men under a famous leader.
Yeah.
He calls them little caterpillars, Xin Ma Chong.
Wow, caterpillars.
Yeah. And he promises to, quote, slaughter all those little caterpillars.
It just sets a psychological tone, you know? And he sees them as insects, nothing more. And that immediately gets a reaction from Yu Lei, the Song commander. But it's not what you'd expect from a tough general.
Right. We know Yu Lei is seasoned. He can handle enemy generals. But when he hears Pu Feng is back, the text says he was frowning and depressed.
Which is weird, right, for a military leader.
It really is. It tells you something about the Song mindset, maybe. Yu Lei spells it out. He's not worried about generals. He fears monks, Taoists, nuns, and women.
Okay, so why those specific groups?
He says they possess yin energy and rely on sorcery Yue Fei. He's not worried about the yang energy of standard military might. That's order, action, structured fighting. He understands that.
So he's basically saying these figures operate outside the normal rules of engagement. Using chaos, maybe.
Exactly. The Song military machine is all yang rationality, bureaucracy, daylight logic. Yin is the opposite. It's darkness, unpredictability, the occult. So when Yu Lei says he fears yin energy, he's admitting right up front that their entire system training, logistics planning, it might be totally useless against a force that just ignores the laws of physics.
That's chilling. It's like admitting defeat before the fight even starts. But his generals don't see it that way, do they?
Not at all. Their chief advisor, Su Gijin, tries to urge caution. You know, let's hold back, plan something.
And how does that go down?
Oh, terribly. This is where the military pride, that yang hubris, kicks in hard. General Jiqing just leaps up, totally dismisses the advice, shouts something like, nonsense, we're proper generals, why fear some monk we already beat? And then he insults Su Gijin personally, calls him bullnose or oxnose. Deeply disrespectful.
So much for caution.
Yeah, it's pure bravado taking over. Three other top generals, Liang Xing, Zhao Yun, and Zhu Qing, they jump right in with Jiqing. They're all about showing strength, not strategic thinking.
Appearance over reality.
Totally. Yeah. So even though Yu Lei is clearly hesitant, deeply worried, the decision gets made. Five generals ride out.
Including the older, more experienced Niu Gao as backup.
Yes. Thankfully, Niu Gao is there too. They ride out to meet Pu Feng. And Pu Feng, he just walks up on foot, leading maybe 3,000 troops.
The generals probably expected a standard duel.
They did. What they got was, well, something else entirely. An assassination, really.
Okay, let's get into that first battle. The generals actually prove they can win the conventional fight initially, right?
They do. Jin goes first. Wolf Tooth Club against Pu Feng's Iron Staff. It's a proper fight.
Then the other three join in.
Yep. Liang Xing, Zhao Yun, Zhao King pile in. Four against one. And Pu Feng is overwhelmed. He's physically losing. He can't beat four skilled warriors at once.
This is the moment, then. The moment Yu Lei feared.
Exactly. Pu Feng knows he can't win conventionally.
Yeah.
So he reaches into his pouch, pulls out the first artifact, the Black Wind Pearl, Hai Feng Zhu.
Okay, the Black Wind Pearl. What happens?
He just tosses this little pearl, a single bead up in the air, shouts one word, Jiri, means quick or hurry. And the transformation is, well, the source calls it nightmarish, that one pearl instantly conjures a black wind. Then it multiplies. Like, one becomes 10, 10 become 100.
Whoa.
Until there are thousands upon thousands of iron pearls. And they're not pebbles. The text says they're the size of bowls.
Bowl-sized iron pearls falling from the sky out of nowhere.
Instantly. Imagine a hailstorm where every hailstone is a cannonball appearing out of thin air. It's a precision kill weapon. Annihilates skill, armor, everything.
The psychological terror alone must have been paralyzing.
You'd think so. But Niu Gao, the elder general, the backup, he reacts incredibly fast.
What does he do?
He fires his special arrow, the cloud-piercing arrow, Chan Yun Jian, instantly.
Work.
Amazingly, yes, the arrow hits whatever magical field was holding the pearls.
Mm.
And poof, thousands of iron pearls just fall to the ground, turning back into that single bead.
So Niu Gao countered the magic.
For a split second, yeah. With sheer speed and a powerful shot. But here's the tragedy. Pu Feng was already on the ground, fighting on foot. Niu Gao was on horseback. Before Niu Gao can even dismount to grab the pearl and his arrow,
Pu Feng snatches them.
Exactly. He grabs the pearl and the arrow. And those four generals, Jiqing, Liang Xing, Zhao Yun, Yu King. They were caught completely off guard by that first horrifying volley. They were killed instantly by those falling iron pearls.
Just like that. All four of them.
Gone. Their arrogance cost them everything. The source sums it up with a grim proverb. The earthen pot cannot avoid breaking on the well's edge. The general cannot avoid dying on the battlefield.
So Niu Gao and the younger generals, they just retrieve the bodies.
That's all they can do, retrieve the corpses. And Pu Feng, he escapes by generating some kind of auspicious light, Qiang Guang, and retreating.
Auspicious light.
Yeah, it suggests he couldn't just immediately reuse the pearl. He needed to get away, maybe recharge it. These artifacts aren't infinite cheat codes, it seems.
Okay, so that first battle is an absolute disaster. Four top generals lost to a magic pearl. That must send shockwaves through the camp.
Massive shockwaves. And it sets up the second battle, which isn't about strategy anymore. It's about grief. Vengeance.
Because Ji King's son, Ji Shenyang, he wants payback, right?
He demands it. And this puts huge pressure on Yulei. The younger commanders are getting restless. They're thinking, our main goal is reaching Five Kingdoms City, and we're stalled here, terrified of one monk.
They see it as paralysis. They need to restore morale.
Exactly. They demand action, even knowing the risk. So Yulei, probably against his better judgment, agrees. He has to restore confidence somehow.
So he forms up his troops again.
Yep. Three divisions this time. They march out. Pu Feng meets them. And when he gets cornered again by a much larger force this time, he pulls out artifact number two.
And this one is the Black Wind Banner. Hai Fengqi.
That's the one. And if the pearl was a precision weapon, this banner, this is something else entirely.
How so?
The pearl was for taking out key targets, assassination almost. The banner is about area denial, mass destruction, total demoralization.
Okay, describe it. What does it look like?
Initially, it's tiny. A small black flag, the source says, not even a foot long. But Pu Feng, when he's surrounded, he shakes it, and it grows dramatically. Suddenly, it's 5 or 6 feet long.
And then?
Then he starts chanting and shaking the flag, and bam, a sudden, violent, evil wind kicks up. The sky instantly fills with dust, yellow sand.
Like a dust storm.
Way worse. It turns into this thick black fog, so dense the generals cannot tell north from south. Total blackout, zero visibility.
For an organized army, that's catastrophic. No command, no control.
Exactly. But it gets even worse. This isn't just fog. It carries things. The source says it brings ice shields and hailstones. Bing, pai, bao, kua.
Weaponized weather, ice shields.
Yeah. Imagine being pelted by huge chunks of ice and hail out of a black fog you can't see through. They flew like locusts, apparently. Hitting the soldiers, breaking heads, bloody noses. Just instant widespread damage.
My God, you can't fight that. You can't even defend against it properly.
There's no defense. It's not a duel. It's just mass destruction raining down.
Yeah.
The soldiers aren't being hit by arrows or swords. They're being crushed by the elements. They can't see. They can't fight back. They can't retreat in any organized way.
So it's a complete rout.
Utterly complete. Pu Feng follows up the storm with a ground charge into the chaos. Yulei has no choice but to order a massive retreat. They fall back 30 leg.
A 30 leg. That's like 30 miles, roughly, a huge distance.
A devastating retreat.
Yeah.
And the casualties are staggering. Over 1,000 killed or trampled in the panic. Countless wounded. A highly trained army just broken by weather manipulation.
So, okay, two battles, two magical artifacts, two catastrophic defeats, the Black Wind Pearl for targeted kills, the Black Wind Banner for mass chaos. What on earth does Yulei do now? He's the commander, but his playbook is useless.
His distress is described as total. And his immediate response tells you everything.
What does he do? Order research into counterspells?
No, nothing like that.
Yeah.
He orders his camp fortified with iron caltrops and deer antlers.
Mm-hmm. Caltrops and deer antlers. Like basic anti-cavalry, anti-infantry obstacles.
Exactly. Iron rhombuses scattered on the ground. Deer horn barriers. The most basic passive defenses imaginable. Designed to slow down a normal ground assault.
So by doing that, he's basically admitting.
He's admitting his entire offensive capability is gone, neutralized. He's not planning to fight Pu Feng anymore. He's just hoping to keep Pu Feng's ordinary soldiers out of the camp.
While accepting that Pu Feng himself can just stand outside and summon another ice storm whenever he wants.
Pretty much. He's completely on the defensive, hoping to just survive.
Yeah.
It's a total admission that conventional military power has failed.
Which brings us back to Ziga Jin, the advisor who got insulted earlier.
Right. And his perspective now seems, well, depressingly accurate. He reiterates his view, saying the generals who died were essentially destined to suffer this ordeal. Zong Diangai Yeno Yegani Fun Monan. It's almost fatalistic.
Exactly. It was unavoidable.
Or at least unavoidable through their means. And this leads to the final strategic point here. The solution has to come from outside.
Outside the military structure.
Completely. Zhu Jijian says that only a high person, a Goren who is coming soon, will be able to break Pu Feng's magic.
A high person, like another powerful individual, maybe another sorcerer.
It implies someone with special abilities, yes, someone outside the normal hierarchy. The message is clear. The Song Army, the rational state-controlled force, has hit a wall. They can't solve this. They need an external, possibly equally supernatural intervention. And then, seemingly out of nowhere, this Taoist priest shows up, Bao Fangzhu. And he claims to be the teacher of the late General Yugo.
Yugo's teacher. Okay, that's a significant arrival.
Oh, absolutely. And his arrival immediately shifts everything. It stops being just a military problem. Suddenly, it's cosmic.
Cosmic. How so?
Well, Bao Fangzhu doesn't talk about troop movements or anything like that. He frames this whole fight as being tied to the destiny of the entire Song Empire.
Ah.
He says, look, normally he stays out of mortal affairs, the red dust, as he calls it. But this time, he has to act. Why? Because the Song Dynasty is destined for revival. The text uses this specific phrase.
Yun he zonking. Destiny aligns with restoration.
Precisely. It's written in the stars, essentially.
Yeah.
And he has to interfere because this conflict is blocking that destiny. He even mentions purple tenuity, Ziwei.
Ziwei.
Yeah.
That's the emperor's star, right? Like the north star, embodying the emperor's celestial authority.
Exactly. So the mandate is coming from the very top, cosmically speaking. When a fight gets in the way of something decreed by Ziwei, well, that's when divine masters have to step in.
It sort of confirms that Yulei had done all he could, like, on the human level.
That's a great way to put it. Mortal power reached its limit. Now the heavens are intervening to guarantee the outcome.
It makes you wonder, though, if destiny is already set by Ziwei, why even have the campaign? Is the fighting just performance?
That's a classic question with these epics. I think it's more that the mortal effort is necessary. It builds merit, shows resolve. But you still need help to remove, well, supernatural obstacles.
And Pu Feng, the demon monk, is definitely supernatural.
Oh, absolutely. We need to dig into who he actually is. Because he's not just some rival strategist. He's called a demon monk, yes. But his real form.
Yeah.
He's a blackfish. When will you? From the Shanwa River.
A fish. Seriously.
Uh-huh. And not just any fish. He's apparently gained immense power by worshiping the Big Dipper for over 1,000 years.
Okay, 1,000-year-old magical fish monk. That's quite the opponent. The villain backgrounds in these stories are always so fascinating.
Right, 1,000 years of worship means he's operating on a very high magical level. You can't just beat him with, you know, arrows and swords.
And there's more to it, isn't there? It's not just random opposition. There's a personal angle.
A very personal angle.
Mm.
Deep spiritual vendetta, really. The text says Pu Feng was specifically sent because Yulei's father, the famous Yufei.
The original hero of the cycle.
That's the one. Yufei had previously killed the son of this powerful entity called the Holy Mother of the Dark Spirit.
Ah, so this is payback. Revenge.
Exactly. It's a demonic payback scheme aimed right at Yufei's lineage, trying to derail that whole Song Dynasty restoration. And that's why Bao Fengzhu has to step in. It's not just a battle. It's an attack on the cosmic order.
Okay, that really elevates the stakes. So Bao Fengzhu arrives, lays out the cosmic situation. What's his actual plan? How do you fight a magic fish?
Well, his advice is surprisingly simple, actually.
Yeah.
And it points out the monk's weakness.
Which is?
Bao Fengzhu tells Yulei, essentially, look, this guy relies only on demon magic. He doesn't have real martial skill or strategy.
Huh. All flash, no substance underneath.
Kind of. So the instruction is just, go back to your old camp at Jishan. Wait for him to challenge you there. And when he uses his magic,
Bao Fengzhu will handle it.
He guarantees it. He'll nullify it.
Yeah.
The location itself, Jishan, isn't the key. The key is just being ready for the magical attack when it comes.
Okay, setting the stage. So the Song forces head back to Jishan, and sure enough,
Pu Feng shows up. He's confident. Probably thinks Yulei's spirit is broken. And he brings his human generals, Shan Shituo and Lian Erxinshan.
And who goes out to meet him?
General Niu Tong. Remember, he's Niu Gao's son. He accepts the challenge.
Right, the son of the master's former pupil.
So Pu Feng tries to end it quickly. He pulls out his first big magical item, the Black Wind Pearl.
The Black Wind Pearl sounds ominous.
It should be. He throws it at Niu Tong, expecting, you know, chaos, maybe an instant kill. It fails. Dropped to the ground. Spins uselessly.
No way.
And here's where the story connects things beautifully. The text explains the pearl was useless because Niu Gao himself had shot it with his famous cloud-piercing arrow.
Niu Gao. His father had already unknowingly saved him.
Exactly. The pearl was already damaged. Wounded, you might say. So Niu Tong survives because of his father's past heroism. It feels earned, in a way.
Wow. So the monk's primary weapon is a dud. What does he do then? Panic.
Pretty much. He ditches the fancy magic for a moment and tries something almost mundane. A sneak attack with an arrow.
Not just any arrow, though.
No. It's the same cloud-piercing arrow he somehow recovered from Niu Yugao earlier. He aims it right at Niu Tong's head.
Desperate move. Showing his true colors, maybe.
Totally. But just as he shoots, Bao Fangzu just casually steps out from the camp entrance.
Perfect timing.
And catches the speeding arrow. Barehanded. No fuss.
Okay, that's a statement. Catching the legendary cloud-piercing arrow like it's nothing.
It's the ultimate display of protection, right? It tells everyone, friend and foe, the rules have changed. Heavenly power is now shielding the Song army.
The monk must have realized then that his simpler tricks weren't going to cut it.
Absolutely. The moment he sees Bao Fangzu catch that arrow, he knows he has to escalate. Big time.
So this is where the really spectacular magic comes in.
Yeah. First, he pulls out the black wind flag. A huge flag.
And what does that do?
Instantly. Dark clouds, black mist surges everywhere. The whole battlefield is plunged into confusion, maybe terror. It's psychological warfare, disrupting formations, blinding soldiers, classic dark magic.
That sounds overwhelming. How does Bao Fangzu counter that?
With pure elegance. He takes out this small, seemingly simple bronze mirror, the treasure light mirror.
A mirror against storm.
He just waves it.
Okay. And
the text says it emits 10,000 rays of light instantly.
Wow. Light versus dark.
Pure Taoist symbolism, right?
Mm.
Clarity and order versus chaos. The light just cuts through the black wind, dissolves the mist, battle clarity restored, army saved from panic.
Okay, round one to the Taoist master. Pu Feng must be furious.
He is. His big elemental display, totally neutralized.
Okay.
So he goes for his, like, ultimate move, weapon multiplication.
Weapon multiplication.
He takes his heavy iron Zen staff, you know, the kind monks carry,
right,
and throws it up into the air.
Yeah.
It multiplies into thousands upon thousands of identical staffs,
uh-huh,
all raining down towards the Song generals.
Thousands of iron staffs. That should be it. Game over.
It should be an instant wipeout of the entire command structure.
Yeah.
Imagine being a soldier watching that.
Yeah, forget fighting. I'd be running.
But Bao Fangzu, he's completely calm, serene even. He takes out his own simple item, a fly whisk. You know, the horsetail whisk Taoists carry.
Okay. A whisk against thousands of staffs.
He just causes it into the air with the command. And the whisk also multiplies perfectly. One whisk for every single staff.
No way.
Yes, they meet midair and just stop. Frozen. Thousands of staffs and thousands of whisks suspended perfectly still above the battlefield. A stalemate.
That image is incredible. A silent midair sculpture of impending violence.
It's amazing, isn't it? The source even says the soldiers on both sides were so stunned, so awestruck by the sight, they actually forgot they were fighting and just started cheering.
Cheering at the magical display. I love that detail.
It's a moment of pure spectacle transcending the war itself. But the stalemate can't last. Bao Fangzu then makes his move.
The checkmate.
Exactly. And it relies on knowing the monk's true nature. Bao Fangzu simply recalls his whisk. Calls it back.
And what happens to the staffs?
As the whisks withdraw, the thousands of staffs don't just fall. They all simultaneously transform.
Into
the monk's true form. Each staff becomes a tiny, 3-inch-long mudfish.
Mudfish. Not the original blackfish.
Well, related. The point is, it's his primal, powerless form. Bao Fangzu didn't just disarm him. He forced the demon back into his weakest state, capturing his very essence in his sleeve.
So Pu Feng is just helpless now, stripped of all that power.
Utterly. 1,000 years of magic gone in an instant. He tries one last thing, a desperate escape. Tries to ride golden light away.
Fly away.
Yeah, tries to leave the ground. But he doesn't even get off the sand.
Oh, I'm down.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Before he can escape, Young Kongshan hits him with an axe. Yulei follows up with a hammer blow to the head. And that's the end of the demon monk.
Violently removed. And does his body?
Yep. The text confirms it. His body instantly reverts to its true form. A not big, not small black fish, dead on the ground. Prophecy fulfilled, spiritual obstacle gone.
Wow. So with the magic fish monk gone, what happens to his human generals?
Well, without their supernatural leader, their morale is shattered. And their magic, if they had any borrowed, is gone too. They fall quickly in pretty standard, though still heroic, combat.
How does it play out?
Yang Jizu deals with Shan Shituo, fakes a retreat, spins, gets him right through the heart with his halberd. Classic move.
Nice. And the other one, Leon Erxenshan.
He gets distracted, seeing his buddy go down. Fatal mistake. Liu Wenlong sees the opening and nails him with his spear right in the throat.
Clean kills. Efficient.
Very. And with both commanders down, the rest of the enemy army just breaks and runs. The Song forces secure a decisive victory at Jishan. The divine intervention basically cleared the path for mortal heroes to finish the job.
So, battle won. Destiny back on track. Does Baofeng Zhu stick around? Yule must have wanted him to.
Oh, he definitely begged him to stay, understandably. But Baofeng Zhu says, no, his task is done.
Just like that.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
He assures them the Song army now has the support of 100 spirits, basically, divine favor, and they'll succeed from here on their own.
Okay. But there's one more little strange event before he leaves, isn't there? General Niu Gao. He's always good for a laugh, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Niu Gao is like the perfect foil to Yule's, you know, serious piety. He's earthy. He's grounded. So when the priest talks about going back to his simple ascetic life,
Niu Gao's like, nah, not for me.
Exactly. He cracks a joke, says something like, you know, master, I admire you, but I just can't handle that King Dan life, that simple, plain existence.
Too boring for him.
Yeah. He says he needs to mix around for a while longer, stay in the thick of it. It's great character stuff, right? Keeps the high-flying magic tethered to, well, people.
It really does, and it sets up this fantastic contrast, because Niu Gao goes straight from joking about fasting to asking for something super practical back.
Yep. An arrow.
Just an arrow.
This arrow, he says, Zazi Jian, he thinks, hey, this might still be useful, you know, for the next battle. He's still in soldier mode. Thinking tactics.
Which just highlights the whole point, doesn't it? He's focused on weapons, on the physical fight ahead.
And Baofeng Zhu just laughs. He laughs at the request, which is a pretty strong signal, right? Like, you're missing the point, my friend.
Why dismiss a perfectly good weapon? Seems wasteful.
Because the priest isn't thinking about the next fight. He's thinking about the destiny that's just been fulfilled. He dismisses the arrow by basically saying, you won't need it.
Oh.
Yeah. He hits him with this counter prophecy, tells Niu Gao his work is done, essentially. His Gong Mingju, his great achievement, his fame, it's already locked in. Imminent.
So the fighting that mattered, the cosmically approved fighting, is over?
That's the implication. The arrow, this tool for more struggle. Obsolete. Your destiny's fulfilled, Niu Gao. Relax.
Okay. Dismissing the practical arrow, but then immediately focusing on something else Niu Gao has. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Right. The priest warns him, hey, don't lose those straw sandals I gave you. The carrier.
Just plain straw sandals.
Seemingly. And again, it's that classic trope, isn't it? The really powerful magic often looks totally ordinary.
Yeah.
Mundane even.
And Niu Gao, ever the practical soldier, he actually has them stashed away safely.
Yep. Confirms they're safe and sound in a little pouch he wears at his waist. It's, you know, responsible, even with simple sandals. So he pulls them out.
And do we get a fancy name for them? Or just sandal.
Oh, we get the name. He retrieves the Polong Elum.
Polong L, wave-breaking slippers.
That's the one. And the name itself is loaded, right? Breaking waves suggests overcoming obstacles, crossing dangerous waters.
Things you'd need to do in a military campaign in that part of China.
Exactly. These weren't just any old sandals. They were likely the magical aid.
Ah. So Niu Gao is holding these. And then the big reveal.
Yeah.
Aha moment.
This is the climax, visually. Baofeng Zhu tells Niu Gao, take a good look. And as Niu Gao stares down at them, they're not straw anymore.
What happened?
Right there, in his hands, they morph. They transform into a pair of shengfu, double mallards, ducks.
Ducks. Wow, that's unexpected, but beautiful. Why ducks, though? Is there symbolism there?
Oh, definitely deep cultural symbolism. Paired ducks or mallards, they often stand for harmony, fidelity, completion, like a partnership that successfully finished its task.
So the mission's complete, harmony restored, the slipper's job is done.
Precisely. Their purpose, breaking the waves, ensuring stability, it's fulfilled. The transformation signals that completion.
And it's not just a static change, right? They become living ducks.
They absolutely do. The description is super dynamic. They open their little duck mouths, flap their wings, and then Hudiyi shungs this sharp sound, and whoosh, they fly straight up into the sky and vanish.
That's incredible. So the magic literally just flies away.
It's the physical proof, isn't it? The magical essence returning to whence it came, its job on Earth finished, the artifact is gone, only the memory remained.
And that That's Baofengzhu's cue to leave, sort of his exit music.
You got it. The moment the ducks are gone, the priest lets out this big hearty laugh like, yep, all done. Then, classic Taoist move, he summons some auspicious clouds, hops on.
Seriously, rides clouds.
Rides the clouds, and Shashi Bujian disappears instantly. Gone. It's the final, you know, flourish. The supernatural aid has officially clocked out. Yulei has taken 3 days to prep. He's rested his troops, got them ready. Now he's advancing on Muyang City, the goal. The officials sweep the north mandate, clear the way, bring back the two sages. Standard campaign objectives initially.
Okay, so let's break down that initial setup. It sounds pretty standard, militarily speaking. Yulei splits his force. Two vanguards, 10,000 troops each. That's a solid force. And the first vanguard, the pointy end of the spear that's led by Ouyang Kongshan, he's got this amazing title, Five Directional Jupiter.
He does. Sounds impressive, right? Okay. And his deputies are Yulei and Delay, so a strong command team for the first wave.
But they're not marching into an empty city. What's the Jin defense look like?
Well, Muyang City is held by Wan Yinshou. Hi, Shou. He's Jin Imperial Clan, so high status, high stakes for him. And the description of him, it's designed to impress, tiger-headed and leopard-eyed, wielding a nine-ring link blade. You know, this isn't just some random garrison commander. He's presented as a serious obstacle.
Right, a proper antagonist. But it gets more complicated, doesn't it? It's not just Jin loyalists he has.
Exactly. This is where you see the internal politics bleeding into the military situation. Wan Yinshou is being helped by two specific defectors from the Song side, Qi Guangzu and Qi Jizu.
Ugh. The sons of Qi Fang, I remember reading about them. Their reason for defecting was kind of petty.
It absolutely was. It wasn't some grand ideological shift. They lost face in a martial arts competition, a lay tie back in the capital, Lenin. They felt ashamed, ran off, and joined the Jin. It's a small detail, but it really highlights how messy loyalty could be. Personal grudges, saving face, that stuff mattered just as much as the big picture sometimes. Really humanizes the conflict in a way.
Okay, so back to the battlefield. Ouyang Kongshan, Five Directional Jupiter, rides out, challenges Wan Yinshou. This is the classic general versus general showdown setup. You expect a long, drawn-out fight here.
You do. And that's precisely where the author pulls the rug out from under you. It's narrative shock value. Instead of this epic duel, it's brutally short, like 20 to 30 rounds. That's almost nothing in these kinds of stories for main generals. There's this moment described where Ouyang Kongshan's hand just relaxes slightly, maybe a lapse in concentration, chik, and Wan Yinshou is instantly on him, strikes him right at the waist, kills him.
Yeah.
Cut down from his horse, done.
Wow. Just like that. A top general, gone. That's a really bold move by the author. It immediately tells you Wan Yinshou is deadly serious. And maybe Yulei's current leadership structure isn't enough. It forces a change.
Precisely. It signals that this campaign won't be easy. It won't follow the expected heroic script. And the aftermath really drives home the shock and the loss. Yulei and Delay, they have to charge in frantically. They use their four hammers, basically causing chaos, just to grab Ouyang Kongshan's body and get out. And they can't even give him a proper rites. They have to bury him quickly, temporarily, under a mound.
Yeah.
Because they lost. The shame is palpable.
Okay, so that failure, it must have sent shockwaves through the Song camp. What's the immediate reaction?
Pure rage, mostly. Nutong, who's leading the second vanguard, he shows up, sees what happened, and he just loses it. Wants to storm the city right then and there. Pure vengeance. Screaming out, turning it into a white wasteland.
Understandable emotion, but probably terrible strategy.
Exactly. And luckily, the other generals manage to calm him down. They know they have to wait for Yulei, the Grand Marshal, to arrive and make the call. But here's the interesting thing. This setback, it doesn't just shake the Song. It actually makes the Jin side, specifically Wan Yinshou, rethink things.
Wait, why? Wan Yinshou just scored a massive victory, killed a key enemy general. Shouldn't he be feeling pretty confident?
Ah, but that shows he's not just a fighter. He's thinking strategically. He might have won the duel, but he looks around and sees the bigger picture. He knows he's still heavily outnumbered against Yulei's entire army, which hasn't even fully arrived yet. So he doesn't sit back. He immediately sends an urgent message, a petition for reinforcements, back to the Jin leadership in Huanglong Prefecture. Even in victory, he knows he needs help. That's smart command.
Right. So this ripples upwards. The Jin leadership realizes, okay, maybe our current forces at Muyang City aren't going to cut it against Yulei's full push.
Exactly. Which leads to this crucial meeting. The Jin ruler calls in Prince Wuzu, Yulei, a major figure we've seen before.
And Wuzu comes up with a plan, a two-pronged plan, if I recall correctly.
That's it. and it's a mix of the conventional and the unconventional. Prong one, military backup. Get Marshal Shurda Kor from Yaguan Pass down to Moyang City with his troops. Stat. Makes sense. Standard reinforcement.
Okay, logical. But prong two. This is where things take a sharp turn, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. This is where the story signals we are leaving the realm of purely historical warfare now. Wuzhu says he will personally undertake a journey to Wanjin Mountain, to the Thousand Flower Cave. Why? To recruit the Sacred Mother Wu Ling.
The Sacred Mother Wu Ling. And she's not just some wise woman, right? She supposedly has serious power.
Serious is an understatement. The text says she has the power to move mountains and overturn seas. Literal, earth-shattering power. Plus, she commands 3,000 elite troops called fish scale troops. So Wuzhu isn't just getting an advisor. He's trying to recruit a supernatural WMD. This completely changes the nature of the conflict. Mortal tactics might not apply anymore.
Incredible. So the Song are planning their next move, thinking swords and spears, and the Jin are literally trying to weaponize geography. While Wuzhu is off on his mystical recruitment mission, that first part of the plan happens, right? The conventional aid?
Yes. Marshal Shurda gets the imperial order. He sets out immediately from Yaguan Pass, and he brings his troops and also his daughter, Shi Yunxiaomei, Hanje. They arrive at Muyang City to bolster Wan Yinshou.
So the Jin defenses are strengthened, but the Song haven't been idle. They're ready for round two.
Driven by vengeance now, not just strategy.
Exactly. The very next day, the Song army issues its challenge again. The mood's shifted. it's not just grief, it's fury. And the champion who rides out this time, it's not one of the established generals. It's someone much younger.
It is. It's Yu Ting, the third son of the great Yu Fei himself, the late Marshal Prince. And the way he's described, it's pure heroic destiny. White robe, seven star silver armor. He has celestial bone spirit, thousand foot soaring heroic spirit. It's like the author is saying, here comes the legacy.
But hang on. From a purely strategic view, after losing a top general like Uyang Kongshan, is sending Yufei's son out smart? I mean, he's young. Isn't that a huge risk? What if he falls too? That could break the army's spirit completely.
It's a massive risk, yes. But you could argue it's a calculated one, maybe more for narrative and morale than pure tactics. They needed a symbolic victory after that devastating loss. Who better to embody righteous vengeance and restore faith than the son of the revered Yufei? It's about reasserting the moral high ground, the mandate of their campaign.
Okay, I see that. And his opponent is the newly arrived Marshal Shurda. How's he described?
Shurda's presented as physically imposing too, but more grounded. Bristly beard, face as red as a cooked shrimp, love that detail eyes like lightning. He tries to pull rank, basically.
No.
Sees this young guy and immediately dismisses him, calls him a milk-smelling little barbarian, trying to intimidate him with age and experience.
So the experienced veteran versus the destined young hero. How does the duel go? Does experience win?
It doesn't. The duel lasts about 30 to 40 rounds. Interestingly, around the same length as the fatal duel the day before. Shurda is strong, he's brave, experienced, but Yu Ting's fighting style, it's described almost poetically. His silver spear moves like flying cloud and flashing lightning. It's suggesting speed, skill, maybe even a kind of grace that overwhelms brute force. It's youthful dynamism against established power.
And Yu Ting wins.
Decisively. He finds an opening, runs Yurda through the shoulder. The marshal falls from his horse, and Yu Ting finishes the job. Kills him. Takes his head. Vengeance served. A huge morale boost for the Song. Perfectly balances the scales after Yang Kongshan's death.
Fantastic. So Song victory, the troops must have surged forward then.
They did. Seeing their young champion victorious, killing the enemy marshal, the Song army charges. But Wan Yinshou, again, proves he's a capable defender. He acts fast, gets the drawbridge up, uses rolling logs, stones, the usual siege defenses to hold them off, prevents a total rout or the city falling right then. So Yu Lei, wisely, orders a retreat to consolidate. They won the duel, killed a marshal, big success. He makes sure Yu Ting gets full credit, records his great merit. Jin camp is in chaos.
Okay.
Their general Shurda has just been killed by Yu Ting, one of Yufei's descendants. So tensions are high.
And the focus shifts immediately, doesn't it, to his daughter?
To his daughter, Shiyun.
Right.
Get this picture. She's in full white mourning clothes.
Right. Shiyun rides out. She's in mourning, but she's leading the charge.
She is. She calls out Yu Ting by name. They call him Yu Sanye in the text.
Right.
She demands he come out and, well, pay for her father's life.
Uh-huh.
Threatens the whole Song camp.
And Yu Ting comes out, spear ready.
He does. Charges out. They fight. But it's it's surprisingly short.
How short?
Like 7 or 8 rounds. Then Shi Yun does this thing she pretends to lose.
The feigned retreat.
Exactly. The classic Rima Baizu. She turns her horse like she's running.
And Yu Ting, probably furious and thinking he's won.
He chases her, pursues really closely. Big mistake.
Because she's got something up her sleeve. Or in her bag.
Literally. She reaches into this yellow silk bag she carries and pulls out the first secret weapon.
The yin dart.
The yin dart. And the description is just a black light. That's it. Throws it right at his face.
A black light? What does that even mean? What happens?
Well, the effect is immediate. Yu Ting feels this intense cold, this Han Jin. The text says he literally can't stay on his horse.
He just falls off.
Collapses right off the saddle. He'd be dead or captured right there. Yeah. But his comrade, Fan Cheng, jumps in and rescues him.
Wow. Okay, so we need to pause here. Like you said, this isn't standard warfare.
Not at all. This establishes Shi Yun isn't playing by the usual rules. She's using something else.
Is it poison? Magic? What are these darts?
You know, in these kinds of epics, it's often a mix. Could be alchemy, could be minor magic, talismans, chemically treated darts.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, they signal she operates outside the normal code of martial skill. Facing her isn't just about being a better fighter.
It's like she has a cheat code.
Pretty much. You can't just block it with a spear. It's surprise, and it's unconventional.
And Fan Cheng learns that the hard way, right? He steps in to fight her.
He does. Steps in bravely. They clash for just maybe 3 or 4 rounds.
Does she feign retreat again?
Nope. This time, weapon number 2 comes out.
Which is?
The Yang dart. This one's described as a firelight.
Firelight. Okay, so yin is cold, yang is hot. Makes sense.
Seems so. It hits Fan Cheng. He just screams, ah, yeah, and boom, falls off his horse too.
So 2 Song generals down, just like that, using weapons nobody can defend against.
Exactly. Think about the psychological impact. She's just taken out 2 leaders in minutes. She seems untouchable. Who's going to fight her next?
Right. Who is going to fight her? She seems unbeatable. Revenge looks imminent.
Well, another Song general steps up. Wu Lian. He wields a facepole halberd. Mian Ganji promises he'll capture her.
Okay. Another challenger. So does she use another dart?
No. This is where the whole story just pivots dramatically.
How so?
Because the text suddenly stops talking about the fighting and starts talking about Wu Lian. Specifically, how incredibly good-looking he is.
Wait, what? In the middle of a battle sequence?
Right. It's jarring.
Yeah.
But crucial. He's got this purple-gold crown, handsome features. They compare him to Pan An.
Pan An. The, like, symbol of male beauty in Chinese history.
The very same. Mm. And even calls him a living bodhisattva. Describes his face like powder. I mean, the text really lays it on thick.
Okay. So Shi Yun sees this guy.
And everything changes instantly.
Oh.
The revenge mission, gone.
Gone, just like that.
Oof. She literally thinks to herself something like, wow, I've never seen anyone this handsome back home. It would be a total waste not to capture the southern barbarian alive and, you know, marry him.
Marry him. She wants to capture him to marry him mid-battle while seeking revenge for her father.
That's exactly what happens. Her entire objective flips.
Yeah.
From blood vengeance to a forced marriage proposal.
Is the text judging her for this? Is it seen as a weakness or just impulsive?
It's presented as just overwhelming infatuation. It highlights that emotional vulnerability, you know, even in the fiercest warriors. Her ruthlessness is still there, but the goal is now completely personal, selfish even.
So what happens in the duel? They actually fight.
Oh, yeah. They fight for over 10 rounds. He's clearly a good fighter.
And then, let me guess, feigned retreat.
You got it. Wima Yuzu, she turns and runs again.
And Wu Lian chases her. Probably thinks he can handle the darts this time.
Maybe. But she doesn't use the darts on him. She wants him alive, remember?
Right. So new weapon.
New weapon. Her ultimate capture device. The Bailong Day.
The white dragon belt, what does that do?
She just throws it up in the air.
Yeah.
It falls down on Wu Lian looking like a white dragon.
Like a literal dragon.
Well, it acts like one. It instantly wraps around him, binds him up completely tight.
Yeah.
Jin Jin Kunding.
Jin Kunding!
He's just captured. Like that. No fight.
Just like that. Helpless. She throws him over her horse, carries him back into the Jin City.
And the Song Army can't rescue him?
Lu Wenlong and others try, but nope. She gets inside, raises the drawbridge. Done deal.
Wow. So 2 generals downed with darts, 1 incredibly handsome general captured with a magic belt.
Yeah.
Shi Yun had quite a day. A very productive, if romantically redirected day.
Mm.
Right. So now the action shifts. It moves off the battlefield inside the city walls. And it becomes about the prisoner, Wu Lian.
Okay. He's captured, bound. What happens to him? Execution.
Not if Shi Yun has anything to say about it.
Mm.
She puts him in a Zian She, basically a trap wagon, a cage.
Right.
And then she sends her trusted maid, Kai Hong, to him. Not with threats, but with a proposal.
The marriage proposal.
Yeah.
Already.
The deal is,
yeah,
switch sides, join the Jin, marry me, and you'll get wealth, status, the whole package.
And Wu Lian. What does he say to being captured by a magic belt and proposed to?
Well, Wu Lian isn't just a pretty face. He's smart. A strategist. He doesn't just refuse, and he doesn't just agree.
He plays it cool.
He plays it brilliantly. He pretends to be interested, and says, okay, maybe, but.
There's always a but. What's the condition?
It's huge, and incredibly political. He tells Kai Hong, look, my sworn brother, a guy named Ouyang Kongshan, he was killed.
Okay.
He was killed by your marshal, Wan Yanshou.
Ooh. Okay, I see where this might be going.
Exactly. Wu Lian says, you want me to marry you? You want me to bring the other Yu brothers over to your side? Fine. But first,
you have to avenge my brother.
By killing Wan Yanshou, your own supreme commander.
That is audacious. He's basically asking his captor to commit treason against her own leader.
It's genius.
Mm.
He immediately turns her infatuation into a weapon against the Jin command structure itself. He's using her feelings to target her boss.
Does she? Does she even consider it?
Well, the conflict escalates immediately. Because just then, Wan Yanshou, the marshal, sends an officer.
To do what?
To demand the prisoner. Wan Yanshou wants Wu Lian executed. Now.
Okay, moment of truth for Shi Yun. Her potential husband or her marshal of direct order?
She flatly refuses the officer. Doesn't even hesitate.
Wow, on what grounds?
She makes up this pretty thin excuse. Says her father's revenge isn't complete yet. She needs to execute Wu Lian later alongside Yu Ting, you know, for maximum impact. Public spectacle.
But the real reason is she wants to marry him.
Of course. She's protecting her prize. But this is direct insubordination. Refusing an order from the marshal.
How does Wan Yanshou react to that?
He is furious. Absolutely enraged. The text says he calls her a Zaibi. A rogue slave girl, basically. A thief. A treacherous servant.
So it's not just a disagreement anymore, it's open conflict.
It's a major rift. Wu Lian's gambit worked perfectly. This one romantic impulse, weaponized by the prisoner, has just created this fatal crack right at the top of the Jin military.
Okay, so Wan Yanshou is furious. Shi Yun refused his order. What does he do next? He can't just let that stand, surely.
No, he can't. His pride is wounded, his authority challenged. So the next day, he decides he needs to reassert himself publicly.
How?
He challenges the Song army himself, rides out to fight, and just to rub it in Shi Yun's face, he sends word to her, basically inviting her to come watch the battle. come see how a real general fights, girl.
Oh, that is just dripping with arrogance. He's trying to humiliate her.
Totally. And it backfires spectacularly.
Who comes out from the Song say?
Lu Wenlong. Remember him. He wields the Lu Cheng Kang, the six sinking spears. He's a top-tier fighter.
Okay, so this is a serious duel. Wan Yanshou versus Lu Wenlong.
Very serious. They go at it hard. 40, maybe 50 rounds. The text calls it a match between two fierce stars. It's a proper fight.
Who is winning?
Wan Yanshou is losing. Badly. He's getting pushed back.
So now he needs help. Does he call for Shi Yun, the one he invited to watch?
He does. He cries out for her assistance, the help she was supposed to provide as his subordinate general.
And Shi Yun, she's right there, watching, as invited. What does she do?
This is the moment. The ultimate betrayal. She's right there, on her horse, near the drawbridge, watching. And she does nothing, absolutely nothing. The text is specific. Le Mazan Shijibu Donshin, holding the reins, standing motionless, just watching him lose.
She lets him die to fulfill Wu Lian's condition.
She chooses the prisoner over her marshal. Her infatuation, combined with maybe a bit of her own ambition and resentment, it seals his fate.
So Lu Wenlong finishes him off.
Quickly, catches up as Wan Yanshou tries to flee, stabs him, knocks him right into the river. He becomes, as the text puts it, a Shuizong Shigi, a ghost in the water.
Brutal. But Shi Yun, she's not just letting him die, is she? She's thinking ahead.
Oh, multiple steps ahead. The second Wan Yanshou goes down, what does she do?
Raises the drawbridge.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Slams it shut, secures the city, prevents Lu Wenlong and the Song forces from storming in after their victory.
Smart move defensively. But wait, what about Wan Yanshou's other generals, his allies?
Trapped. Qi Guangzu and Qi Jizu, his allies, are caught outside the gate when she raises the bridge.
Oh no, what happens to them?
They get trampled to death by their own retreating soldiers trying to escape Lu Wenlong. It's chaos.
So Xi'an, in one move, lets her rival die, fulfills Wu Lian's condition, secures the city, but sacrifices two more Jin commanders in the process.
Exactly. She achieved her objectives perfectly. Eliminated her rival, kept her potential husband safe, held the city, all fueled by that initial infatuation. She effectively purged the Jin High Command for a handsome face.
Wow. Okay, so Wang Yuanshou is dead. His allies are dead. The battle's over for the day. What's the mood inside the city?
Well, Xi'an seems pretty pleased with herself. But first, she has to deal with Wang Yuanshou's daughter, Rui Xian.
Ah, the grieving daughter. How does that go?
Xi'an basically gives her a quick pat on the shoulder, a few words of comfort, and then dismisses her. She's got more important things on her mind.
Namely, Wu Lian.
Exactly. She feels triumphant. In her view, she's done it. She's met his condition. Wang Yuanshou is dead.
So she sends the maid, Kai Hong, back to the trap wagon.
Straight back. Tells Kai Hong to relay the news. Marshal Wang Yuanshou. Killed by that Song general, Lu Wenlong.
Does she admit she just stood by?
Oh, yeah. She makes sure Wu Lian knows. The message includes the crucial detail. Zuo Shibuju. I sat watching and did not save him. She's claiming credit for his death by inaction.
She's basically saying, see, I did what you asked. Now uphold your end of the bargain.
Precisely. And she doesn't waste any time. The offer comes immediately after the news.
The final offer.
Marry me. Tonight. The text says, Chenji Jane Ye Yelchin, take advantage of this auspicious night.
Tonight?
Yeah.
Seriously, the marshal's body is barely cold.
She's not sentimental, and she sweetens the deal considerably.
How? More wealth?
Better. She offers him the Shuai Yin.
The marshal's seal, the actual symbol of command for the entire Jin army in that theater.
The very same. She's offering him supreme military authority. Basically, marry me tonight and you can be the new marshal tomorrow.
That's an incredible offer. Power, position, marriage, all tied together, all because she thought he was handsome.
It's the ultimate power play, fueled by infatuation. Control of the army in exchange for, well, she hopes, control of his heart.
And how does the chapter end? Does Wu Lian accept?
Ah, that's the cliffhanger. The source material leaves us right there. It just closes with this very poetic classical metaphor. Something like, the fallen flowers have intent, but it turns into a loveless marriage. The flowing water is heartless, yet they become a loving couple. The goddess has her heart set on the Chu Peak, but the king has no dream of the Yang Terrace.
So the goddess Xi'an has made her move, offered everything.
But the king, Wu Lin, his true intentions, his dream, remain unknown. Is he genuinely tempted? Or is this still part of his larger strategy? We don't know.